KALW.
Every year in school, Chayza found a way to announce to the class that he had four parents and two of them were in prison.
How a decision Chayza Boudin's parents made shaped his path from public defender's office to the prosecutor's seat.
I felt this sadness, you know, rush over me because I wanted him to win so much.
Today, the first installment of a new series, The Progressive Prosecutor. Then, a book takes a deep dive into the fashion and lives of seniors living in various Chinatowns.
Clothes became a gateway to tell stories about their immigration, about what they did before they retired, and just how they lived their lives in Chinatown.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. For decades, district attorneys have helped drive the mass incarceration boom in the United States. Prosecutors have nearly unlimited discretion to decide how to pursue cases. When Chayza Boudin took the helm as the city's top prosecutor in San Francisco, he promised to be different. He pledged to use the power of the DA's office to reform the justice system. Over the next few weeks, we'll be taking a closer look at Boudin's first year in office in a series called The Progressive Prosecutor. And in this first story, KALW's Holly J. McDeed reports on Boudin's unlikely path to the San Francisco DA's office.
Last January, Chayza Boudin was sworn in as San Francisco's 29th district attorney. And one of the people he thanked was his mom, Kathy Boudin, who was there in the audience. She had served over two decades in prison for her role in a 1981 robbery that left three people dead.
Your incarceration lasted 22 years. But your love and support are endless.
And he also spoke about his father, who was not there because he's still serving time in a New York State prison for his role in that same robbery.
He can't be here today because he sits in a cage. It did not matter to the DA or the judge, in your case, that neither one of you was armed, nor that neither one of you personally hurt anyone. Those details, they matter to me.
Clearly, this was no ordinary swearing-in ceremony. The star of The Last Black Man in San Francisco emceed, and civil rights activist Angela Davis was in the audience. And live from D.C. on a big screen, none other than Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
We are all safer when we uplift victims, hold everyone accountable for their actions, and do so with empathy and compassion. I wish you much success in all you will do. Thank you for giving us hope.
It rocked the house. It brought the house down.
That's prosecutor and former public defender Armando Miranda. For Miranda, this moment was like watching a brother and a friend become district attorney. Boudin was considered the radical candidate during the election, a position that earned him the endorsement of Bernie Sanders. But not everyone was a fan.
When a gang member commits a violent crime, shouldn't they go to prison for as long as the law allows?
During the campaign, the San Francisco Police Officers Association spent over $650,000 to stop him from winning. Tony Montoya is president of the San Francisco Police Union. He says the ads weren't personal, and he actually thinks Boudin is a pleasant guy who worked harder than anyone to win the DA's race.
And if your only interaction was 30 to 60 seconds with him, he seemed like a very, very viable candidate, and yeah, that would be a good district attorney. But when you start to peel back the layers of the onion and actually see what his policies were about.
The police union opposed Boudin based on his support of diversion for first-time DUI offenders and eliminating gang enhancements. The race was tight, but Boudin won. A big reason for his victory seems to be his backstory. Boudin was born in New York City in 1980 at the dawn of the Reagan era. He talked openly during the race about being the son of radical activists. His parents were part of the Weather Underground. The group had bombed the State Department, the Pentagon, and the Capitol in the 70s. Its mission was to overthrow the imperialist American government.
At 7:30 this morning, KPFK received a call from a woman identifying herself as a member of the Weather Underground.
Hello. I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war. This is the first communication from the Weatherman Underground. Kids know the lines are drawn.
When Boudin was 14 months old, his parents left him with a babysitter to join members of the Black Liberation Army in the robbery of a Brinks armored truck in Nanuet, New York.
And went to participate as drivers in an armed robbery. The robbery went terribly wrong. One of the security guards on the scene was shot and killed.
Boudin's parents were the getaway drivers.
My parents were arrested that day and obviously never came back to get me at the babysitter.
Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayres were leaders of the Weather Underground and friends with Boudin's parents. They remember hearing on the radio that they had been arrested.
And we freaked out, got a friend downstairs to come sit with the kids once they were asleep, and took a walk down Broadway trying to figure out what the heck we could do.
The Brinks robbery was all over the news.
Among the four suspects arrested was Catherine Boudin, a fugitive since March 6, 1970, when she reportedly fled naked from the flaming ruins of a Greenwich Village townhouse turned bomb factory.
After the Brinks robbery, Dorn and Ayres remember taking the train to see Boudin's grandparents.
Here they were at a stage in their life when they should be sitting back in a chair and surveying the wonderful things of their life. They suddenly had a 14-month-old baby to take care of. And
their daughter in jail charged with murder.
Their daughter charged with murder.
So they were frantic, as you can imagine.
They were pretty frantic. And so Bernadine and I went down every day. We brought our kids down, and we tried to just listen and to be helpful. But then we said to each other, if this were us, and we had lost our kids out into the void, who would we want to take care of them? And we decided it would be us.
Dorn and Ayres raised Boudin in Chicago. Together with a wide support network, they tried to mitigate some of the damage that happens when infants are separated from their parents. Boudin struggled in school at first and didn't learn to read until the third grade, but he was able to have private therapists and tutors and attend an elite private school. And he also stayed connected to his parents. Dorn remembers how Boudin would sit on a chair next to the wall where the phone was and talk to them.
And they, you know, made up stories, they sang songs.
Kathy was an absolute genius at figuring out how to parent from prison. And David was as well. She never let go, they never let go of their contact.
Ayres says Boudin began asking why his parents committed the crime that led to their sentence when he was 4 or 5 years old.
The question of, was I abandoned? And do you care about me, of course, was a haunting question. I mean, if you know young children, the whole sense of basic trust is developed when you're about a year old or a couple of years old.
Ayres says the answer Boudin's parents told him was that they had made a mistake.
And so they latched on to this idea that the important thing is to say, you're perfect, you didn't do anything wrong, and we love you unconditionally.
Boudin grew up in the wealthy Hyde Park neighborhood of Chicago. He and his adopted parents became kind of like tutors, tasked with explaining incarceration to the enlightened progressive community.
You know, every year in school, the opening week of school, Chayza, on his own initiative and his own brilliance, found a way to announce to the class that he had 4 parents and 2 of them were in prison.
Ayres and Dorn were not surprised by Boudin's career path.
You know, people said to him, you'll probably be a lawyer because he was argumentative, and that's what you say to argumentative kids. But also, his grandfather was a famous lawyer, his uncle was a lawyer, his mother was a lawyer.
And Boudin, he enrolled in Yale Law School, and in 2009 published a book about traveling through Latin America called Gringo, A Coming of Age in Latin America. During a book reading, someone in the audience asked him what he plans to do after law school.
Yeah, I think one of the great things about law, I think one of the reasons that probably many of my colleagues who are here today from the law school chose to study law is because it's the currency of power. It touches every single area of life, whether sports, whether human rights, whether labor, whether business, financial interests. It's a lens through which to work and understand and analyze the world. And I'm not sure that it's necessarily going to determine my career path, but I hope it will give me tools to be more effective in advocating for the change I believe in.
Then in 2012, he started a fellowship at the San Francisco Public Defender's Office. Carmen Aguirre was his manager when he landed in the misdemeanors unit. She says he was such an unusual guy in an office with a lot of people who can have very strong rebellious streaks. He had a seemingly boundless amount of energy and curiosity about how to make the criminal justice system work better.
And what the problems are. And so that was just him as a young attorney, you know? I mean, which he still technically very much is. But just as like a baby public defender, a baby litigator, that was the energy that he brought that was pretty unique.
Aguirre says, think of the misdemeanor unit like junior high. New attorneys are trying to figure out what they're doing, and there's a lot of frenetic energy. And then there are the teacher's pets, attorneys who are kind of like Eddie Haskell from Leave It to Beaver.
Chesa is a guy who was always pleasing authority, but not because he was trying to please authority. It was just sort of like in his true nature to, like, his nerdyism, for lack of a better word, his quality of being very nerdy is very much a part of his essence.
It's clear that Boudin's desire to make the system more fair motivated his interest in bail reform while public defender.
And so rich people can buy their freedom, they can fight their cases, work with their lawyers, maintain their innocence from the comfort of their own homes while they continue to be employed and take care of their kids and their families. Well, poor people have to sit in jail, lose their homes, lose their cars, lose custody of their kids, and ultimately are coerced into pleading guilty, often to crimes they did not commit.
Aguirre says that as he became a champion for the movement to end cash bail, he seemed to talk more about his parents and his background.
I guess it felt like he galvanized this energy that he had stored up around his experience with his parents and started to channel all that energy into the fight about cash bail.
Then in 2018, DA George Gascón announced he would not run for re-election. For the first time in over a century, an incumbent was not entering the district attorney's race. Boudin decided to run. He knew that if he really wanted to transform the system, it would be easier to do so from a position with more power. That was the DA's office. Public defender Carmen Aguirre says his win still seemed like a long shot. She remembers walking in the Hall of Justice before the election. It felt like prosecutors, sheriffs, and judges viewed Boudin's campaign as a threat or as a joke.
Not a funny joke, not people laughing at him, but like people angry, like an angry joke. Like, people didn't take it seriously, but to the extent that they were at all afraid or felt like it might happen, they were angry about it.
Boudin's friend and colleague, Armando Miranda, remembers seeing him in Pacific Heights.
Handing out literature. This was during his campaign. I felt such emotion when I saw him. I also felt... I felt... this sadness, you know, rush over me because I wanted him to win so much, and I was worrying about him. And he was getting so skinny. And I went up to him, I gave him a hug. And I just wished him well. What he was doing out there every day was so brave. And I just felt all this emotion well up in me when I saw him there on my street corner by himself.
Boudin learned he won the DA's race while flying home from a visit with his dad at a prison in upstate New York. He could not have predicted that unlikely scenario growing up. And months later, at a swearing-in ceremony, Boudin spoke about probability. He spoke about the odds being stacked against any kid with incarcerated parents. And he spoke about his childhood friend, Lorenzo, who he looked up to. They became friends while visiting their moms in prison.
We came from different worlds. He was poor, black, and an immigrant. Lorenzo was every bit as intelligent as I was.
Boudin said the disparities in their lives became all the more clear as they grew up. On the one side of the coin, there was Boudin, who went to Yale Law School, became a public defender, and then a top prosecutor. On the other side, there was Lorenzo, who ended up incarcerated himself.
Lorenzo was deported to a country he had never even known, as I was on my way to Oxford. For Lorenzo, the odds played out. Anyone who sets foot inside a criminal courtroom will see these odds play out time and time and time again. An endless parade of predominantly black and brown faces, nearly all of whom lack the opportunities that I was granted. Join me. Join this movement. Join us in rejecting the notion that to be free, we must cage others.
With hundreds in the audience, Chesa promised that at least in San Francisco, he would attempt to make the city's justice system more fair. And as the top law enforcement official, he'd have more power to decide when to show mercy and when punishment is needed. In San Francisco, I'm Holly D. McDeed for Cross Currents.
That story was co-reported by Alice Wolfley with help from Christopher Agusa. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Photographer Andrea Lowe and writer Valerie Liu began featuring San Francisco Chinatown elders on their blog back in 2014. While talking to seniors about knit layers, they learned there were many layers to these elders' lives, and the blog led to the book Chinatown Pretty. It features photos and stories from senior Chinatown residents across North America, including San Francisco and Oakland. They've captured the beauty of these elders in their everyday styles, from dapper sweaters and slacks to big floral prints and sweatsuits. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with co-authors Andrea and Valerie.
So how did this project come about?
Yeah, Andrea and I would go on dim sum dates in Chinatown, and we both realized we had this same response to seeing an awesome outfit. And we both were like, who are these people? And like, where did they get their shoes? So it was born out of our desire to understand like how these seniors put their outfits together. And from there, clothes became a gateway to tell stories about their immigration, about what they did before they retired, and just how they lived their lives in Chinatown.
Right, yeah, Chinatown Pretty, it describes a style that we noticed first in San Francisco where we started the project. And it's this really fascinating patchwork of different patterns, colors, oftentimes really bold patterns like florals, mixed with handmade clothing, gifted clothing, new clothing. So there's a bunch of different eras. As well as a lot of utilitarian features. So this is all like in one outfit. So for example, you might see like seven layers, like a handmade sweater with a puffy jacket, a Supreme baseball cap, maybe gifted from their grandkids. It's this really fascinating mix, and it represents a lot of personal histories and cultural values.
I was interested too that a lot of people you interviewed, they make their clothes.
Yeah, working as a seamstress or in a clothing factory or as a tailor was a job that a lot of people had because it didn't necessarily require English. And so some of the people wore clothes that they made from leftover fabric or that their fellow colleagues had made for them. So it's about being resourceful and industrious.
I used to go to Chinatown. Me and my mother, we would shop in Oakland, Chinatown quite often. And I think sometimes we erase elders. We, you know, we invisibilize them. And I never really took the time to really notice, you know, what they had on.
Yeah, you kind of catch them in these moments that are, you know, in between. They might not actually have been dressed to, quote unquote, go out. They're just kind of running an errand. This is how they dress day to day.
Was it a challenge to get them to photograph these people? Because you're going up to people on the street like, hey, we're making a book. And were they thinking like, I just have on my smock and turtleneck?
That's probably the biggest challenge with this project is getting people to stop, right? These are really busy seniors. They're out there getting the best jujubes or bok choy while they're grocery shopping, and they have their city blinders on. Are we kind of a process, kind of a dance down after 6 years of doing this? And so what we'll do is we'll take laps. If we see someone we really want to speak to, we'll kind of run out in front of them so that we can wave and say like, hey, like, how's it going? Oh my God, I love your hat. Or, you know, kind of point out something that we're interested in, and just trying to get them to stop is step one. After that, we ask them more about their hat and what they're up to. And then sometimes it evolves into like their life story. And then from there, we'll be like, hey, well, can we take your picture? We're doing this project, and we explain what Chinatown Pretty is and that our goal is to celebrate them, their lives, their outfits, their stories. And we lose people along the way. Some people will tell us their life story, but will not consent to a photo. Some people are happy to take a photo, but only have a few minutes before they have to board their bus. So yeah, each story, each photo is hard earned.
There was so many interesting stories. I mean, the book is not just photos. Really compelling stories. One story that really struck me was a woman. She had long hair, and she said she felt young inside. And she was talking about being adopted, or she was in foster care, and she didn't know why her. Oh, here she goes. She's this lady, Miss Estelle Kelly. What are some stories that just stood out to you talking to these people?
Yeah, you were talking about Estelle, and she, we had a chance to, you know, sit down and talk with her at length after the initial portrait. And she has a really fascinating life, like you mentioned, growing up in an orphanage and then becoming a dancer at one of the nightclubs in Chinatown, Forbidden City. And she stood out in a lot of ways to us because her story is so unique.
I think Estelle is a great story. And then there's also just little moments. For example, I think we titled her as Cool Cat in Oakland, Chinatown. But she kind of has like slick back hair, and she's wearing this mustard vest. Mm-hmm. When we met her in Oakland, Chinatown, she was grocery shopping with her daughter. And, you know, her daughter was like, no, spoke on her mom's behalf, like, no, you cannot take a photo. We're not interested. And when her daughter went into shop, her mom kind of leaned up against the pole and gave us the coolest smug look. And we're just like, yeah, you can go ahead. And and so for that, we didn't get any stories from her, any details, but just the experience of her being like, you know, do it while my daughter's not looking. And her attitude just like radiated like coolness. She was such a cool cat.
Okay. So I'm going to ask a messy question. Which Chinatown is the best dressed? Ooh.
So we've been to quite a few Chinatowns, and I think San Francisco is where the heart is, the heart of Chinatown Pretty fashion is. And this is, you know, largely to the huge, you know, senior population that is still living and thriving and grocery shopping in San Francisco Chinatown. It's also really due to our weather. Because of the ever-shifting climates, you have to be prepared. And sometimes that means 9 layers. Sometimes it means a jacket, a fanny pack, a backpack. So more is more. More layers means just more interesting textures.
Yes, I'd have to agree on that. It's where we started the project. And yeah, I think that's where it has like the strongest, has the strongest flavor of Chinatown Pretty.
That was photographer Andrea Lowe and writer Valerie Liu speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. Their book, Chinatown Pretty, is available in bookstores. We'll have links at KALW.org. And before we go, here's some new music from a local artist. This is Bomb Snacks from Oakland, and their latest single, Dale Dale, dropped in November.
Me salen movimientos de la nada y me salvan. de sumisión. Te convierten en mis alas y me llevan hasta el cielo. Sigue subiendo la flama cada vez que vivo en mi visión. Con la cadera torcida y las manos arriba me lanzo en otra vibración.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Azul Ekman, David Exume, and Marissa Ortega Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shirin Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Me gusta ver gotitas escapando de mi frente. Eso, dale, hasta que la noche se acabe. Yeah.